I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everybody. This is Kevin, and I'm here with Samantha and Dr. Kevin Del Duca. And today we're going to talk about emergency medicine. And we're really excited to have Kevin here with us today. And we're going to talk a lot about some of the basics of emergency medicine, some of the experiences he has at the Matsu Regional Hospital where he works. But he also just recently came off of Mount McKinley doing a month up there as a volunteer. So we want to hear about high altitude care that he provided up in that environment.
Hi, everyone. This is Sam, and I'd like to introduce everyone to Dr. Kevin Del Duca. So I'm going to give you his bio. Dr. Kevin Del Duca grew up in the town of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He is certified by the American Board of Emergency Medicine. He received his medical degree at Penn State and received his undergraduate degree at Brown University. He completed his ER residency at Orlando Regional Medical Center and worked at Oakland Children's Hospital as a pediatric emergency specialist. Dr. Del Duca has lived and worked in Palmer since 1995. This year, he was a volunteer with the National Park Service on Denali for a month, and we're going to talk a little bit about that experience as well as his experiences in the ER, as Kevin said. So welcome to the show, Dr. Del Duca.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Absolutely. You know, I was actually on Facebook this morning. I saw this article come through. It was talking about an emergency room doctor who was asked what are the most, the five common grilling mistakes made for summer grilling season and the things he was seeing in the emergency room. So anyway, I just thought that was an interesting
Yeah, have you seen any emergency room level grilling mistakes this year yet?
No, I haven't. But I've been on the mountain, and so the kind of injuries we have from cooking are carbon monoxide and just burns to the fingers, and hot water is being spilled. But I can imagine you can get pretty injured grilling.
Well, especially okay. If you use gasoline, right?
Oh, yeah, that's a common problem with mostly trash fires in these parts.
Yeah, well, number five on the list was leaving the grill unattended, so that was a big one. But what was surprising to me was one in cases of wire bristles being swallowed and having to be surgically removed. So the number one thing was to actually wipe down the grill with a wet cloth because those bristles come off and actually get lodged in the meat. So that was a pretty surprising
Anything
one.
Can happen to anybody at any time.
So maybe we could talk about some of the, what are some of the common things you see coming in? Is there a seasonal aspect to what comes into the emergency room?
Well, we definitely have seasonal sort of struggles with different illnesses. Of course, snow machining has its season, and trauma is all 12 months. But the kinds of trauma you see varies from season to season depending on what people are doing. And so, to emphasize prevention, always wear a helmet whenever you get on anything motorized, and you don't want to add alcohol to motor vehicles and machines. And so we see quite a bit of trauma in Alaska per capita. We see a lot of interesting kinds of trauma when we compare ourselves to other states and other countries. Certainly, we have seasonal flu and influenza is pretty much common throughout the northern hemisphere that season in the winter. And of course, there's been a lot of talk about this terrible influenza that may come and cause a pandemic. So we're constantly vigilant on what could happen and how we might respond. And we're constantly challenged in our communities, especially this one, by the growth, and so we've been having growing pains, which is not a bad thing. Since I got here 17 years ago, we've grown quite a bit, and that's a challenge to the entire community, including the medical community.
So back to what you were saying about trauma, we don't have a trauma center in the state of Alaska, correct? I mean, it's really what it happens in the emergency room. You guys are dealing with trauma, but you don't. In other states, sometimes there are specific trauma centers where people dealing with traumatic injuries are sent automatically to those hospitals. So with you, pretty much, like, what kind of trauma can you handle, and what do you have to refer to Anchorage, and what actually has to be, what kinds of patients need to be moved out of state?
Well, the history of emergency medicine goes back to the 60s, and the National Academy of Sciences, the National Research Council report in 1966 titled Accidental Death and Disability, the Neglected Disease of Modern Society, first ushered the way into the Highway Safety Act of 1966, which established a cabinet-level Department of Transportation person and the authority of this department to improve emergency medical services. And funding from the federal government continued through the EMS Act of 1973. And a lot of people parallel these acts of the lawmakers of this country with the end of the Vietnam War. And a lot of what was learned in the Vietnam War was adapted in our emergency medical services in that time. And that was basically the beginning of emergency medicine as a specialty in and of itself. It's one of the most recent innovations in medicine, in that, you know, internal medicine goes back centuries, surgery even goes back centuries, but certainly all these things have grown exponentially in our own lifetime.
So we're talking about really the past 40, 45 years, really, that emergency medicine has been a specialty?
That is correct, yeah. So it's constantly evolving. We're constantly having growing pains. We're constantly adjusting. I'm very proud of our community because we set ourselves to that task of adapting to the problems as they are studied and unveiled and articulated and addressed. And so it's really a privilege to be a member of a group of people that are dedicated to that.
Definitely. And, you know, I'm kind of wondering about the process of emergency medicine. So there's triage care. Is that, as I understand, you're in this this place where you've got, you know, any number of kinds of conditions coming into the emergency room, and you only have so many resources, and you have to be able to differentiate what's happening according to acute need. And so is there a system that it's part of the training of how to handle that, and it involves a whole team of people? What are some of the mechanics of that?
Well, the triage process is very important on a day-to-day basis in any hospital and emergency department, and clearly when there's a mass casualty event or a cataclysmic event like an earthquake or a tidal wave. So the triage is a French word that means to sort through. And so you sort through and you assign a level of severity to patients. And I'm trying to answer your question. I didn't answer your question, your initial question about the trauma center
issue.
We'll
go back to that. That's cool. Answer his question first, and you can go back to mine.
But if you have a trained medic on a radio that tells you, you know, there was a car accident and there's been a death on the scene and there's entrapment and there's, you know, they give you vital signs that indicate someone's very, very sick. Well, our facility is very adept at dealing with very sick people that have traumatic problems. And in the last 17 years, we've improved greatly. We don't quite have the services that would be required for a level one trauma center, but we're working on becoming a trauma center. And there's a lot of hoops to jump through. And getting back to the question of triage, once you find someone who's very sick, that's viable. That's the person you give your resources to. I was recently on Denali and was given the scenario of three climbers, and this was given to me by my patrol leader, and we had arrived at 14, and he wanted to be sure that if there was a big fall that, you know, I would know how to respond and do my role in the patrol. So he gave me a scenario where there were two viable climbers who were very badly hurt and one non-viable person who was actually and in my day-to-day practice, I usually don't get that scenario. So right. I was challenged by that particular scenario.
So you have two people who are can probably make it if they get care, and you have one person that's definitely not going to make it no matter what you do.
And so the way you assess people is airway, breathing, circulation, and where you are. So if you're on the side of a mountain at 14,000 feet and there's a raging storm, your process of triage is a little bit different than if you're in Palmer, Alaska, and it's just another day and there's a bad four-wheel accident or a construction accident.
I'm thinking that that process, just like what you're saying about location, is pretty interestingly different, because there was an accident back when we were living in Anchorage. I'm thinking it's been 10 years. A bunch of climbers were roped together, and I think 8 or 10 people fell basically down a mountain, all roped together. Can you remember?
Oh, yeah, that was on Ptarmigan Peak.
Ptarmigan Peak, yeah, mm-hmm. That was it. You know, and then so what you saw, what people had to do at the bottom of that disaster, you know, right there to do, you know, just to get people stabilized, to get them out, to get them to the emergency room, is probably a different process. And once they arrive in the emergency room and you figure out what you're going to do next.
That was a very unfortunate accident with far-reaching repercussions in throughout Alaska and the field of wilderness medicine. And it was very fortunate that the National Guard responded with Black Hawk helicopters to that scene, and those people were evacuated very efficiently because it was an accident that occurred very close to the city. People were nearby. And, you know, they were taken to the hospitals in Anchorage. And I believe two people did die from that. And there was certainly some litigation with UAA and their Wilderness Medical Studies Program. And that was very unfortunate. There were lessons to be learned from that in terms of practices that are safe when descending on with three rope teams, a narrow snowfield that's steep, and the kinds of footwear that people should have and the kinds of techniques they should use to make sure that everybody, if someone slips, are able to support that fall and anchor that fall. And that was just an amazingly bad outcome from just a lot of things that went wrong.
Yeah, and we haven't had anything on that caliber in a long time, right, that you can think of?
No. Yeah. No. No.
So maybe some lessons were learned.
Yeah. Yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask what were some of the big points you learned being up on Denali?
I learned quite a bit about the challenges to rescue in a very, very desolate place that's hard to reach, and how well the Park Service has adapted to that. Challenge. Over the years, the camp that they've been setting up at 14,000 feet has evolved. And when I first heard of it, there was a local doctor by the name of Peter Hackett who worked at Alaska Regional, who established this camp as a research center. And the climbers viewed him as somewhat as an angel. If they got into trouble, he was always ready to help. So this research center sort of evolved into a medical clinic, which sort of backfired because you had a lot of people using it and not using their own common sense and getting into trouble and then continuing to climb and getting into further trouble and then needing a full rescue, which would put rescuers at danger. So I think that there is still research going on. A lot of my colleagues are still publishing data that they get from the 14,000 foot camp, and I think the camp still is a wonderful place if you happen to fall and have a serious injury to get a helicopter ride out. But it's not meant to just help you get down by a helicopter because you're having a bad trip.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because we had a conversation before talking on the radio about once you have something happening, you know, you break your ankle or you get pulmonary edema, like you have to go down. Like once something happens, you need to actually go down. You don't get to hang out and wait and see if the thing's going to get better, because at 14,000 feet, things don't get better. So that's one thing I think a lot of people think, oh, well, I'll go up and try again after this gets better, but they're really not going to get better at 14,000 feet. They need to go down. And then what you just said about people sort of relying on the medical care that they're going to get them out of trouble, and actually what it sounds like to me you're saying is that everybody should go up on the mountain acting like you're not there. And the fact that you are there is a bonus. And if people really legitimately get into trouble, it's great that you're there to help them out. But in general, people should be prepared to take care of themselves.
Exactly. The Park Service is charged with the welfare of about 1,000 climbers every year. And it's a very serious undertaking that they take very seriously. And they have, you know, resources, but they don't have unlimited resources. So you have to be careful and save the oxygen for the person who's dying, not the person who's having an anxiety attack. You know, you have to save the helicopter for the person who has cerebral edema or pulmonary edema, which are forms of high-altitude illness. And if someone has a blown-out knee from an avalanche, maybe they can limp down. Probably they won't, but as far as the challenge to the Park Service, it's a challenge that we have in our society every day. There's people that, you know, act irresponsibly or present with complaints that they could probably address on their own, and that's just, those are the minority of occurrences, and you know, we just have to do the best we can, and we are all basically working in the same community, whether it's on the side of a mountain, if you're there, you're part of the community, or whether you're in Palmer, Alaska, you know, be safe, be thoughtful, and be conscientious of other people, and try not to get other people in trouble.
Right, but it's a different scenario when you're on the side of the mountain, because if you get in trouble, you're potentially endangering a lot of other people, versus where, you know, if you do something stupid, I don't even know if that's the right word, but if you do something that was, could have been preventable, I'm not talking about falling and tripping, or, you know, some people, you know, set off an avalanche, and there's an argument on whether avalanches are preventable or not, you know, if you're reading the signs correctly, or is it just because, well, I really want to go up there, so I'm going to ignore the signs, so I'm sure that kind of stuff happens, but it sounds like what you're saying is that people really have to look at that they're responsible not just for themselves, but if they get into trouble, somebody else is going to have to come get them if they get into really serious trouble. And so how do they keep themselves from putting other people into danger?
Yeah. And so in regards to the message of this program, you know, what can happen in a microcosm of on the side of Denali happens every day in every community across the land. And that is, sometimes people make decisions that aren't thought through very well, and it can put other people in jeopardy. So whether you're on a raft in the Kinnick River, or you're kayaking down the Little Sioux, or you're backcountry skiing in Hatcher Pass, you have to know the risks, specifically wear helmet, wear a life preserver, wear a beacon, you know, try to know about avalanches. It's tragic when they occur. You know, it's tragic when you trigger an avalanche and somebody else is buried. So the protective devices are important. The education is important, but it always comes down to the human factor and whether you decide to actually do something and how you decide to do it.
And I want to remind our listeners, we are interviewing Dr. Kevin Del Duca about his experiences as an ER doctor in Alaska and also about his recent experience last month as a doctor on Denali at the 14,000-foot camp. This is Sam, and Kevin's here with me. And I do want to go back to one thing that you said, because we just kind of breezed over pulmonary edema and cerebral edema.
Yeah.
And so people who aren't climbers may not know what those two things are, and I'm sure those are two big issues that you deal with on Denali when you're dealing with altitude. So can you explain to people what pulmonary edema is and what cerebral edema is?
And why is it that some people get it and others don't?
Those are all great questions. So altitude illness can occur in various forms, and acute mountain sickness is the most common. And if you, for instance, go to Colorado to ski, you might get acute mountain sickness with a headache and other nonspecific symptoms of anorexia. Your appetite's decreased. You might just have general malaise. And that can progress to cerebral edema, where you have extravascular fluid collecting in the brain all sorts of physiological processes occurring as soon as you go to altitude. I think I have some notes here. That as soon as you go to altitude, within minutes, your body starts to adjust. But it's an adjustment that may take 2 or 3 weeks. And it's sort of a concert of of the ventilatory system, the circulatory system, hematological system, and the neurological systems, as well as the kidneys, all interacting in very complicated ways. So going back to acute mountain sickness, some people view that on the continuum of cerebral edema. And if you have high-altitude cerebral edema, otherwise known as HACE, you must descend immediately to get better. There are other therapies that you can employ, like oxygen and steroids and Diamox, and these things help temper the process of cerebral edema. But until you actually leave the altitude and go back to sea level, you can die. You will be at risk of dying. And we had a patient on the mountain that we used a thing called a Gamow bag, and Gamow was the inventor of a bag that you can pump up the pressure and actually from 14,000 feet have them in this bag descend to a partial pressure of oxygen that might be found at 9,000 feet. And it's a temporizing measure, but the main treatment is evacuation by a safe means. So then, to go on, pulmonary edema is caused, all these things are caused by hypobaric hypoxia, or basically...
it's not enough pressure.
Not enough oxygen.
Low oxygen pressure, right.
The partial pressure of oxygen is always 20%, but the barometric pressure decreases with altitude. And so you have a low amount of oxygen at a certain elevation, and it causes pulmonary arterial vasoconstriction, and that is felt to predispose one to pulmonary edema. So pulmonary hypertension is caused by one low oxygen, and then you have another cascade of events that results in some people getting pulmonary edema. And again, you're some people are genetically predisposed to it. Had a patient this past visit to Denali that was from Norway, and he'd had the same problems on Kilimanjaro, and he was at 11,000 feet, and his PO2 was 65%, and his lungs were full of fluid. And that's not typical to be just at 11,000 feet and to be that sick. And he just needed to be told to leave, and which he happily did. And by the time he was down to the 7,200 base camp, he was fine.
And then there are some people who genetically can actually climb peaks like 14,000, like Ed Vesters, I think, is one who climbed all the 14 peaks over 8,000 meters without oxygen.
He can function at an O2 saturation of 30% quite well if he acclimatizes slowly, and so can a lot of people. And the acclimatization process needs time to occur. So the general recommended rate of ascent is 1,000 feet per day. And so some people get into trouble when they try to climb a peak too fast and won't give the body time to acclimatize. All the physiological changes that I mentioned or alluded to, from the ventilatory, circulatory, hematologic, and cerebral and renal systems, need time to work. So it's interesting you bring such a great climber up, and yeah, he can function at an O2 saturation of arterial oxygen saturation of 30%. Most of us are 90 to 100%, mm-hmm. And so that's very drastic, and he's an extreme
Most people
athlete.
Would just pass out.
Well, even if you took Ed Vesters, and God forbid you would ever do this to anybody, immediately to the summit of Everest,
he would pass out too. Right?
He would pass away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just can't go from 100% to 30% and survive.
Which is interesting when you're talking about how ascending 1,000 feet per day. But there's a certain elevation where you can't, even if you're I think it's above 17,000 feet, where basically your body starts to cannibalize itself, right? I mean, you
muscle
can't really
is
live
consumed,
there. You have to go down eventually.
And
yeah.
And people who study this think that the reason that you lose muscle mass is so that the distance between the little capillaries through which your blood is flowing and the oxygen is flowing, between them and the mitochondria, the powerhouses of the muscle cells, is decreased when you lose muscle mass. And so oxygen is more readily available to the power cells, the mitochondria, power plants of the cells of the body.
Yeah, because I've read about the Sherpas who are help assisting on Everest, for instance, and these people seem to know that they can work there, but they still have to descend down lower than 17,000 feet if they're going to live. So they can't actually just live at 17,000 feet 24/7. It's not going to work. So they actually have to spend a certain amount of time below that altitude in order to replenish themselves and get back up there.
I guess, your body sort of cannibalizes itself in the lack of oxygen environment.
You know, I'm kind of curious if there's long-term health consequences for those that might experience pulmonary edema, or is there something down the road that could become problematic, or is this like a temporary condition? The body will heal fine.
I think it's a temporary condition as long as you can descend, and since it's limited to its survivability, either you descend and you survive, or you don't and you die. But I don't think people with a predisposition to pulmonary edema, like my friend that I met from Norway, will be going to elevation anytime soon, and I suspect that he learned that if he does, he'll go a lot slower. And it's like everything in life, it's a trial and error process.
Did you feel like you might want to climb yourself? Is that something that you've done or that you want to do?
Well, climbing means a lot of things to a lot of people. And for me, climbing means skiing, backcountry skiing and snowboarding in Alaska and glacier travel. But I think technical climbing is rock climbing, involves lots of ropes and knots and anchors. And that was a really interesting thing about being on Denali with my ranger patrol, is I was with rock climbers with a high skill with roping things up and people up and skiing them down mountains those are very hard skills to come by, and it's a unique set of people that have those skills. They're generally people who work seasonal jobs. They're not settled in a community. A lot of these people don't have health insurance, but they just love what they do, and they're inspired by the fulfillment that they get out of it. So climbers are a very interesting group of people. I would not call myself a climber as much as an Alaskan resident who likes to backcountry ski. But I did learn a lot about, you know, ropes and anchors, and I have studied that for years. But I don't practice rock climbing rock walls, which is, I think, one of the essential skills of a climber.
And I want to ask you a question about vision, because I know a lot of people have had laser eye surgery, and there was a previous kind of eye surgery, I think it was called PRK, where they actually made little slits in the I guess it wouldn't have been in the cornea, but over the cornea, like to change the shape of the eye. And I've heard stories about climbers who, after having the laser eye surgery, that once they get up to altitude, that all of a sudden they lose their vision, or they're more susceptible
that they can't
to
see.
Yeah, or they're more susceptible to frostbite on their eyes. Did you get to see anything?
Well,
like
there
that?
Was a lot of talk about the first I heard about that was the pathologist, I believe his name was Beck Weathers, who was in the terrible climbing accident.
It was 1996 on Everest.
Was it 96? Yeah. And that was when everybody really scrutinized that year on Everest for a lot of reasons. He basically had some kind of eye surgery, mm-hmm. and he lost his ability to see well. There was a big long line at Hillary Step, and people took longer than they needed to, and there was interactions between various climbing groups that resulted in people being delayed and running out of oxygen and being stuck on the mountain and having radio contact, and there was internet going on, then there was a book written, Into Thin Air, and
by John Krakauer, in case anybody's interested.
Yeah.
Did you actually see that? Did you see anybody having vision issues up at altitude, or was that not a problem?
You know, I saw someone after they had summited, had frostbitten their face quite badly. And when you get above 17,000 feet on Denali, you can experience winds 40 miles an hour and temperatures 20 below quite frequently. And you can get into the realm of a minus 100 degree wind chill factor very quickly. And if you don't have sort of a space suit, meaning goggles that won't fog up and headgear that covers all the entire scalp and face and neck and hands that are, you know, big mittens, maybe some hand warmers in there. If you can't be in this sort of a space suit, then you shouldn't go up there.
So exposed anything is going to
freeze in 10
seconds.
Anything exposed in those conditions, a big wind will blow, and you will sustain frostbite. So this person I saw, not a patient, but the side of her face was frozen, and I had concerns about, you know, the function of her eyelids 2-3 weeks into the down the road. And that's the thing about frostbite is it's not initially apparent how serious the injury is. It takes a few weeks for it to delineate. But, I mean, you can see a frozen hand and realize someone's going to need some amputations, and you can see a bad facial frostbite and be concerned about the function of somebody's face. Again, I don't have an extensive experience following frostbite people. They tend to pass through on their way back to the lower 48.
I'm going to interrupt you right there because I'm getting the note that we need to take our mid-talk break. So we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Kevin Del Duca talking about emergency medicine.
Radio is what you make it. If you want to be involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us on the web, radiofreepalmer.org. We're looking for ideas, we're looking for volunteers, and we're looking for help. Thank you so much, and enjoy.
Support for Radio Free Palmer comes from the Palmer Downtown Deli. Palmer Downtown Deli provides free Wi-Fi in an informal, casual, conversational environment, or for just individual solace. Breakfast, lunch, or dinner dishes, wraps, specialty sandwiches, soups, or desserts, including gelato Italian ice cream, are offered along with coffee, espresso, tea, specialty waters, or drinks. Music Arts performing live can be enjoyed every Saturday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. A comprehensive summary of Palmer Downtown Deli's menu options can be found at palmerdeli.com, and phone orders at 745-4100 are available as well. The Palmer Downtown Deli is located on South Alaska Street. The Palmer Downtown Deli, supporting community connectivity and community radio.
Back here with The Bridge to Everywhere, Kevin and Sam speaking with Dr. Kevin Del Duca, emergency room physician at Matsu Regional Hospital. We've been talking about emergency medicine as he was practicing for a month up on Denali, and one of the things that we hope to get to is maybe a lot of folks are out camping and hiking in the backcountry in Alaska. Are there some things that they should be bringing just to be prepared for a medical emergency?
Yeah, I think it's important that you have a medical kit that addresses your own personal medical needs, and that's certainly something that you should talk about with your doctor. And if you don't have a doctor, maybe you have a guide, a Wolfer certified guide. But there are certain medications at altitude that I think people should carry. I think people should have antibiotics if they're out on the North Slope on a kayaking trip or a hiking trip for months at a time, or even weeks at a time. Some more strenuous type of undertakings, you might want to have a muscle relaxant or a pain pill. And again, that's something you should talk about over with your doctor. The main thing is prevention and staying out of trouble and making sure that you continue to take the medicines that you're supposed to take, especially if you happen to have a heart disease. All of us tend to be in denial about our physical state to some degree or another, and I happen to meet some people that you know, stop taking their heart medications and go on a big, long, extended trip, and that's not really recommended, obviously. But a good medical kit, you know, I know captains of fishing boats, they have places they go to get their medical kits, and the programs like Knowles and Wrangell Mountain Center, they have physician sponsors that can help them fill their medical kits. But the main thing is also training. And so if you're going to be out and about, depending on what you're doing, get specific training regarding that activity. And certainly a Wolfer class, a Wilderness First Responders, would be an excellent introduction for anybody who wants to live in Alaska and see the last great place on Earth.
So the medical kit is a really good idea, but and I know people who've been hauling around the same medical kit for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, and it just never got opened, so they don't even know what's in it. So not just having the medical kit, but like you said, like probably once a year, taking everything out and looking at what's in there, see if anything's expired, make sure the duct tape and the, you know, is still sticky, and make sure the moleskin still isn't, you know, isn't soggy and all that kind of stuff. Like actually look at what you have and know
exactly
what to do with it.
If you have anaphylactic type reactions, you need an up-to-date EpiPen. And your Benadryl and your steroid and your inhaler and all the things that you normally would need, especially you might need desperately if you're on a 10-day trip in the middle of nowhere.
Right. I think about it in terms of, you know, like how we recommended to change the batteries in the smoke detector or check them twice a year. You know, they've equated that with daylight savings time, or, you know, every time you change the clocks, check your smoke detector battery. So it might be a good idea, you know, every beginning of the season, you know, summer rolls around, check the kit, make sure everything's in there. You know, I forgot. I actually used such and such on our last trip and I didn't remember to replace it. And now here I am out in the middle of nowhere and I really could use that thing and oops, I don't have it. So I know it seems like, you know, that would make sense, but I think a lot of us just assume, oh yeah, everything's already in the kit, I don't need to look.
Yeah, you definitely need to look at your kit, and it's good to have a beacon, an emergency locator beacon, or a satellite phone. Communication can be very, very important. Can certainly help address the severity of the need, whether it's life-threatening or just some discomfort or just a change in plan is necessary.
Great. We want to encourage you to get in touch with us on Facebook to ask any questions you might have for Dr. Kevin Del Duca on emergency medicine. Just go to our Facebook page, Bridge to Everywhere, and type, you'll see our photograph of the three of us. You can just type in under that photograph if you have a question.
So we'd like to talk about in the ER, what are some of the common things that you see? And maybe you could go about talking about that just to give us a sense of what, I know there isn't really any typical day in the ER, but what kind of give us a sense of what a typical day might look like, you know, like mix up a couple of different days and make that into what, like what would your average day look like in the emergency room? What kinds of things would you see?
Well, I learned early on in Orlando, Florida, where I was training, that you can have the best moment of your day followed by the worst moment, and there might be a minute in between.
Wow.
And it's just the process of moving from one room to another, from one patient to another, from giving somebody good news to giving somebody bad news.
Do you have a particular story in mind there that you're referring to?
Well, when I think of Orlando, Florida, I think of a family of four, husband and wife and two small children that were on the little ride that you take from the parking lot to the gate, and it's
just
basically
a tram ride.
It's a tram that runs around the parking lot, and I think it was the end of the day, and they were going back to their cars, and the little boy was excited, and he dropped his toy, and he ended up doing what you should never do when you're on a tram that's moving, is he got up and he fell, and so his mother jumped after him and hit her head so badly that she had intracranial hemorrhage and was comatose, and having to tell her husband, you know, and I believe they were from another state, that was the case, was just devastating for him, and it was just a moment that you don't want to have, or you don't want to have to convey that kind of information.
You know, when we were preparing for acupuncture school, one of the requirements was that we would spend time traveling with EMTs or with the fire.
Or working in the emergency room, so I worked in the Anchorage emergency room.
I was struck by, just in the time that I was riding with the fire crew, just how going into homes where they were addressing a call, people just living their lives, just having breakfast, you know, just it's like kind of like what you're saying. One minute everything is absolutely fine, the next minute there's a tragedy unfolding. And it just really struck me the significance of just how important every single day is, and that, you know, things do happen pretty fast. I remember on Christmas Eve, Sam and I were just out with some friends putting some decorations on some trees outdoors with their young son, and, you know, he was just throwing bird seed around. He was having a good old time.
We had these big bird seed balls that we were making, you know, like putting bird seed together with peanut butter and hanging them on the trees, mm-hmm. like for the birds. And he was just chucking the ones that didn't have strings on them into the woods. And mm-hmm. it was getting kind of dark, and he threw one, and he happened to throw it right directly at me. And because it was dark, I didn't see it coming, and it slammed right into my open eye.
Oh my!
So yeah.
So from, you know, celebrating Christmas Eve, having a great time, to, you know, speeding to the emergency room with Sam having birdseed in her eye and just crying. You know, the pain was
yeah,
another,
it was like lacerated cornea.
Yeah, that's very painful. And then you worry about your vision, mm-hmm. and you overlay all that anxiety on top of the actual injury, and it's very traumatic. And I bet while you were in the emergency department, you remember exactly what the nurse said, or exactly what the doctor said.
Well, what I remember
to them now, 10 years later,
sure, they
might
have
not
no idea.
They might not even remember.
Yeah. But what I actually remember is they offered me pain meds, and because I was an acupuncturist, I thought, oh, I don't need pain meds. They numbed my eye to get the birdseed out, and then I thought, well, I feel okay now. You know, it was lacerated and it was bloody and everything, but my vision seemed okay. And so they said, are you sure you don't want pain meds? And I said, oh no, I don't do pain meds. I'm a Chinese medical person. So meanwhile, I go home, and of course, after the numbing stuff wore off, I shot into like 10 out of 10 pain and was basically in shock.
She was crawled up in a ball in the living room, rocking back and forth and moaning.
And so did you go back?
Kevin had to go back to the ER and get the pain meds. So I learned. But anyway, it was a really good lesson on the importance of pain meds. That, like, if somebody's in shock, you can't do anything.
Yeah.
You have to first you stop the bleeding and then you get the person out of shock, right?
Well, I can make suggestions to patients, but a lot of times I meet people with, you know, some concern like you had and a belief that they'll be all right. But generally, I can convince people that at 2 a.m. it'll be a different case than at 10 p.m. and that they probably ought to take this prescription and at least have it to go get it filled so they don't have to come back and they can try something else at home before.
Right.
But the main thing is to reassure people that there isn't, you know, a life-threatening emergent problem or a visual problem and be confident that that is true. And so that's the essence of one of the main points of emergency medicine is to be able to figure out who can go home and who can't, and to arrange follow-up for those people that you're concerned about.
So I think we should talk a little bit about red flags. So the kinds of things that, you know, obviously if the person's in a car accident, they're going to the ER. You know, there's some obvious moments where it's very clear this person needs to go to the ER. But what about some of the gray areas where people aren't sure? You know, so if somebody doesn't know, is it heartburn or am I having a heart attack? Or am I just kind of dizzy and tired or did I actually have a stroke? You know, are there some things that you could suggest to help people differentiate?
Yeah, appendicitis or diverticulitis.
Yeah, well, or a stomach ache, you know. Versus
well, the ER has become basically everything to everybody for a lot of reasons, meaning, you know, if you have any problem and no access to medical care, you can come to the emergency department and you will get a medical screening exam and some advice. And that's... I'm very proud to say that, you know, that will occur. That goes back to the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act of 1986, EMTALA, which means regardless of your ability to pay, you will get appropriate care.
So nobody gets refused care when they go into the emergency room. Everybody gets care.
That's true.
Okay. So in terms of those things that I was talking about, then, so, you know, like somebody's trying to differentiate, should they, like, how would you say, well, err on the side of caution if you think this might be a heart attack, you need to come in, or are there some things that you can say that, you know, would differentiate your average case of heartburn from a heart attack? Because some people feel, you know, they feel pressure on the chest or they feel, you know, anxiety or something, and they feel like, oh, you know, they just don't know and they're worried, especially when it comes to somebody's heart. You know, people tend to be, you know, scared when they think there might be something going on with their heart. But I think, but I've heard so many stories now of people going in to the ER and it turned out to be, you know, indigestion or anxiety.
Yeah, it's really difficult to differentiate gastrointestinal pain from cardiac pain sometimes. And it can feel like heartburn when someone's having a heart attack, or they can have pain in their upper abdomen and numbness and tingling in their hands, and it can be from a heart attack. But I'm not saying that everyone with numbness and tingling in their hands is having a heart attack or everybody with indigestion is having a heart attack. So I think if you have a concern and your intuition tells you there might be something wrong, that you should listen to your intuition and have somebody talk to you about it.
So listen to what you're – if you get a sense internally that something's really wrong, don't wait. go to the ER.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. And now, to use your illustration earlier, if somebody happens to suggest something to you, like, hey, you might need pain medicine, be open to that suggestion. That's why you came to the ER.
Right, exactly.
For that suggestion.
I got a lot of humility around that. In fact, I think that experience really taught me, again, the use of pain meds. Like, I didn't, you know, I was a little bit stuck up, I guess, about, you know, about Western medicine in some ways. And what it really taught me was that there are some situations where absolutely you need to use acute care, and that's what it's there for. You know, but the person who's addicted to pain meds for 20 years, that's a different story. But taking pain meds because you're actually in pain is a different story.
It's
so, you know, they're two different things. Yeah, it's a good idea.
Appropriate use of the medicine. So can you maybe walk us through a typical day, how it unfolds for you?
Typical day. I generally start to get ready the day before and get all the things out that I generally have, which is my iPad with my computer programs to help me look up information, a few cards that help me get through, you know, the two-minute drill. We have a few two-minute drills that we routinely do in emergency medicine. And
what's a two-minute drill?
Well, that's a metaphor to a football game where you're within one score and there's 2 minutes left. And so some great quarterbacks can go from the 20-yard line and march 80 yards with a team in 2 minutes and win a football game. And that's a certain skill that they work on. And I think emergency physicians have a few scenarios that I would term a two-minute drill, an airway case or a case where someone needs thrombolytic therapy or a central line, are basically a case that you have to be ready in your mind to just do and get it done quickly. And so for me, getting ready for a shift means running through a couple of scenarios, a couple two-minute drills, and then showing up on time and showing up being enthusiastic about what I'm going to do. We mentioned that when you were in the hospital that perhaps somebody said something to you that you might never forget. But you were just one patient of maybe 100 that day that they saw. And so that's important to be mindful of, the effect that what you say, what I say, what a medical care provider can say in 30 seconds is something that's a person in need or with anxiety or physical illness will carry with them, that information, forever. And it might even be slighted a bit to by their perception of how it was said. That doctor told me that
And interject in there, Deepak Chopra talks a lot about that in his books about, you know, just the power of words, mm-hmm. and how people respond to what people say to them, especially when they're in that state of, you know, heightened anxiety and they're worried something's wrong with them or something's wrong with their kid. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of hyper-focused. So it's definitely, the onus is kind of on you to be very careful about what you say. But Kevin and I have had the experience often where we've heard somebody repeat to us something that they say another healthcare provider said to them, and then, you know, we talk to that healthcare provider later and they absolutely didn't say that. So we wonder what people are repeating that they think that we said. So everybody's got a filter, you know, even if they're not under particular stress, people can hear things in different ways. It's just the nature of being human, you know, because we've all got that little filter between our ear and our brain.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the person is having a medical emergency, there's a vulnerability that comes along with that, and you know, so there's a lot of factors in that. I remember when you were in the emergency room and getting that care, how deliberate, how confident, and how, I mean, everything was very methodical in the way the physician took care of your eye. And I was thinking, man, that is impressive, because you were in so much pain. And so for a person to be able to start working in a delicate area like the eyeball with a person who is in extraordinary pain, and you just have to do what you have to do to get that seed out and flush it out. And, I mean, to be able to keep composure, be caring, be sensitive, but at the same time just do the work that has to be done, I was really impressed.
So let's go back to...
It's even more fun when you're dealing with a three-year-old.
Yeah, I can't imagine what that's like. So let's go back. So you've got that, you're knowing that you may run into some situations where you have to be really mindful of what you say and what the person's listening to.
Well, after 22 years, since I graduated from Penn State Medical School, I think I've made enough mistakes that I've learned enough... ways of communicating and what not to communicate. So, you know, if there's a person having a life-threatening stroke and and someone with bones sticking out of their lower leg in another room, and someone else maybe having a heart attack in another room. When I walk into the room where there's three patients all from the same family that have a cold, you know, I can't tell them, I'm too busy to help you. I have to sit down and make myself available and address their issue in a way that doesn't put what might be considered more seriously medically ill patients at risk by my absence from their particular vicinity or being right next to their bedside. So juggling, you know, the triage process and who's urgent, who's non-emergent, is something that I do in my own head, and I tend not to tell patients where they are on the list of severity of illness.
Right. So you're not waiting tables. In other words, like, whoa, I gotta get that.
I am waiting tables. I often think that public service, no matter what you do, is a matter of service, and so I think no matter what you do, in public service, you do it as best you can, I think that people generally feel the same thing about their day, and we all have the same emotions. So, and we're all tasked and burdened and stressed by our jobs and our obligations. So I don't feel that my obligations are any more demanding than someone in another profession. Say, you know, somebody waiting tables in Denali with 1,000 tourists all around them demanding food. I mean, that's very stressful.
So what do you do? You were talking about that one situation where you had to tell the husband that the wife had, you know, cerebral hemorrhage and she was in a coma. How do you maintain that connection with, you know, there's another person sitting in front of you or lying on the bed in front of you? So you've got that person sitting there. I know this is a complicated question, so I'll take the time that you need to answer. But you've got a human being, you know, with a whole life, you know, maybe in front of them or a whole life behind them and people that love them. There's an actual human being in front of you. But then at the same time, you have to have a certain level of objectivity in order to do your job, because you can't just turn into an emotional ball of mush. And I know a lot of people, you know, they get very confused when they're looking to a doctor. You know, they want a really good surgeon, but they also want a surgeon who's going to be really nice to them. And it seems like sometimes in our culture, you don't end up with somebody who's really excellent at their job, you know, as a surgeon, and also a really, you know, kind, friendly, wonderful, you know, human being to hang out with and have a cup of tea with. Those things don't go together. But it sounds like you're trying to sort of juggle that line between you have a job to do, you need to help the person, you have to look at the priorities, and yet there is a human being, you know, with a full complement of life experiences. How do you take all those into account when you're doing the job that you do?
Well, you want to enlist your patient as an ally in their own health care. And in order to do that, you know, you have to identify, you have to communicate. I think some of the most meaningful interactions I've had with people are ones that maybe started out on the wrong foot, and there was some miscommunication that had to be worked out, and there was some ground traveled in order to come up to a common understanding of or a compromise, if you will, as to the problem and what's causing it and what might be the solutions. Does that answer your question?
I just know it's a challenging position to be in, because just like you said, people are in a state of heightened awareness and they're looking towards you for the answer. And sometimes you might not even have the answer. You know, like sometimes the answer is, I don't know, but I want to help you figure out what the answer is, and I need your help. I need you to help me. And also, you don't want to discount the person. You know, it can be a mistake to lean too far into thinking that, you know, well, they don't, it's their body, you know? So there may be some information that you just haven't gotten from them because you didn't ask it the right way, or they didn't know that it was important. So there's so many factors in there when you're interacting with another human being. It's not just a machine that you can press a button and it gives you a little printout, which would be nice, you know, like, this is what's wrong and this is what needs to be fixed, and you know, you need to do this exam and you need to run this blood test and you need to give this drug. It just can be so much more complicated than that.
Yeah, I agree. But that's what makes it very interesting, and that's the part that I like, and that's the reason I went into this field.
You know, I want to get back to, we were talking about the kinds of medical preparedness or supplies somebody might take for the backcountry. We've only got about 5 minutes left on the show, but I was wondering if there's medical supplies or things that people should be prepared in their households, things that you would recommend, skills or items in first aid that would be really important to have in every household?
Well, you know, if there's an influenza epidemic, pandemic looming, which there was a few years back, everyone was buying up Tamiflu. And I think there's quite a few people around that still have that Tamiflu in their little medical kit. I myself did not get any. But as far as antibiotics and things like that, when you're you don't necessarily need to have those because you can always come down to the ER or come see your doctor and get that. On the other hand, if there was a terrible earthquake, you know, you might need some sort of a survival kit that you might find on board any of the commercial fishing vessels that populate a lot of Alaska. So it also depends on your level of training, you know. I've learned to always have, you know, the ability to suture up a minor laceration because I can do that, and I frequently have friends come over and ask me to do that for them.
So let's go over to Kevin's house and have him sew up my minor laceration.
Yeah, that's
an evening at your house.
Sometimes it is, yeah, in the shop. And people come by and they, you know, so, you know, again, you need to have all the medications that you normally take. And I would talk to your doctor about the kind of kit that you would need given an emergency situation. And that's basically what I'd recommend. Lots of water, flashlights, extra food, definitely.
You know, as professionals in the healthcare field, we are required to have CPR training. And I'm just curious because I, you know, growing up, it was never really something in a household that you would expect. Everybody in the household or somebody in the household should be trained in CPR. But it seems like that would make sense. I mean, any thoughts about that?
I think it's a great thing to know. It's a sort of a class where you learn a little bit of physiology. You learn how to deal with a choking infant or a choking adult, not just doing compressions on the 89-year-old person that had a heart attack for the fifth time. I should say 109-year-old, in case there's any 89-year-olds out there I don't want to traumatize. But I think CPR is a great class. I recommend it. It's available. It may cost money if you're not a healthcare provider, but it's worth it.
So any particular, I would call it a teaching story, like any particular scenario that you might be able to tell from your time in the ER that would be like, okay, here's something that I want everybody to know because I don't want you to do this. Anything like that you can share, some particular thing that stands out in your mind, an experience in the ER that you had that, you know, that just won't ever leave
your
head?
Don't drink and drive. Don't do silly things when you're drinking alcohol. Don't operate any kind of motor vehicle. Don't even get on a bike. You know, just be careful about the choices you make. And certainly accidents are going to happen to people. And if they do happen to you and you're injured, the most important thing you can do is keep your spirits up while you're going through your physical rehab.
That's great. And I'm kind of curious because emergency room medicine, as I understand, is a hard field to actually to be in for a very long time. That I've heard that it can be a burnout profession. You seem to thrive on it and have been in it for a very long time. And just the last minute here, I'm just wondering if you could say a little bit about what you love about it and how you've managed to really ride through so many years.
I like all the little MacGyver techniques that and the ultrasound machine is new, and my new partners that are more recently trained have brought all these technologies and new medications, and it's just always exciting, and I'm always learning something new and furthering my own understanding of the human experience.
You have a favorite gadget, or is it the ultrasound?
The ultrasound is the one I'm working with now. Okay. That's a huge gadget. It is the revolutionizing. It is the stethoscope of the 21st century.
And what about like for home use? Like, what's the weirdest home item that you've used to do emergency? You know, like they show in the movies, people take a pen to open up an airway. You know, any weird, any tricky? You know.
Well, thank goodness I work in a well-provided, stocked emergency department with a wonderful facility and colleagues and backup surgeons and anesthesiologists and nurses and a huge staff of respiratory therapists, and so I don't have to improvise those kinds of things where I work.
Out in the backcountry, though, ever had to improvise? something when you've been, you know, out on a trip somewhere?
I've never had to do an emergency cricothyrotomy in the backcountry. I've always had a kit and lots of people standing by, so thank goodness for that and those people in my facility.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the show. Dr. Kevin Del Duca, emergency room physician at Matsui Regional Hospital.
And next time on the show, we'll have Jim Bellamacy, CEO of Special Olympics Alaska. So please join us in 2 weeks on Bridge to Everywhere. Thanks a lot. Good night.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for joining us on the Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.
Programming support for KVRF Community Radio is provided by Gelato Cadrino Alaska, serving the tasty Italian ice cream to patrons both in Wasilla and now Palmer. Using imported ingredients and local valley dairy products, Gelato Cadrino Alaska uses a fourth-generation Italian gelato recipe. A little experience of Italy and authentic gelato flavors such as hazelnut, chocolate, pistachio, vanilla, and fruit, and many more. Created fresh daily, can be sampled at the Wasilla location at City Center Business Park, 609 South Kinnick Goose Bay Road, and now in Palmer at the Palmer Downtown Deli, 550 South Alaska Street. Gelato Cadrino Alaska, supporting healthy sweet tastes of Matsu Valley and Community Radio.